Hi everyone, thanks for joining us back on another episode of Enablement Evolved. And today I have with me Kieran Smith from Endella, myself Hector from Contura, and our guest today is Ben Purton from RingCentral. And today we'll be talking about the importance of sales enablement going to 2023. So Ben, thank you so much for joining us, really appreciate it. I'd love just to have a little bit of background about yourself and what brings you here today.
So my name is Ben Purton. I've been in enablement, this is my eighth year now. Been 3.5 years with RingCentral. I look after a team across all of international, which is basically a nice way of saying not America, because it's anywhere from here to Australia, so here being the UK where I'm based. So I've been looking after a team there. I've got a team of six, and I've got a few other people that I work with in terms of like dotted lines and stuff like that. But so that's what I've been doing. Passionate about enablement. Also love a bit of chess as well on the time. So if you do have me on LinkedIn, anyone, you'll see a few board game posts as well.
Well, it's interesting for that. And thanks for the introduction, Brian. Obviously, you and I have met a few times now. And I might be about to let a bit of a secret out of the bag, because obviously lots of people know you as the Gary Kasparov of enablement. However, I've seen a different side to you. You're now becoming a little bit more of the Michael Parkinson or one of either ant or deck of enablement events. You've been a hostess with a mostess at a couple that I've been at. So am I letting the cat out of the bag? Is that a potential career change for you in the future?
I do a bit of hosting, but I don't know. Gary Kasparov, you flattered me too much. Parkinson, I'll take. That would be good. I wouldn't mind that. I do some hosting. Enjoy sort of those sort of events. I think the best thing with enablement is if you don't share ideas, then the whole sort of function itself doesn't grow as quickly, because we are still one of the most growing functions out there in most businesses, whether that's tech or even stuff like banking and finance. I mean, I've actually spoke to people, leaders in those areas that are running enablement teams in what I would call more traditional industries that you might not expect it, but never make assumptions.
Obviously, we are a very growing function. I joined enablement probably about 18 months ago, but there's been a lot of rumours, as you well know, that 2023 is going to be the year of enablement. So I know this is a very broad question, but is that something you agree with? And if so, why do you see it being so important?
I agree with it. Whether the market agrees with it is another thing. You know, I got onto this top 50 enablers list from the collective where we met before recently. And that's a fantastic list to be on, big honor to be on it. Yeah, I've seen some of my really esteemed, really talented colleagues, unfortunately, being part of RIFs. And when I see that, I'm like, kind of saying to myself, what are these companies doing? Is there a more important time to have enablement when you're going into a recession? The answer is there's not a more important time. But for many companies, there is more important times, because we don't carry a quota. That's the first thing they sometimes look at. Sometimes they would maybe misunderstand enablement. We're an extension of marketing, or like we help with that facilitation, or we're training developers when it comes to that area. So really, one of the big themes, I think, is 2023 should be the year of enablement. It should be the year that most companies double down on enablement. And the reason is because when do we now need to get, we need to get as much as possible out of as little possible ingredients as we have. If I use an analogy, I know you're a soccer player or football player, but just in case we can have a global audience here, so soccer, with a day after the Super Bowl recording this, so definitely we'll call it soccer. If you don't have your fitness coaches in a soccer capacity, and you go and you sack all your fitness team and your health team, and you go, right, okay, we can do without them. You know, they don't run and score the goals, and the manager tells them the tactics. So your CRO telling the tactics and your salespeople closing the deals. You just get rid of all your fitness coaches. For the first few months or weeks or quarters in our case, you'll probably won't see too much of a difference. Then you get into sort of a few quarters time, and you'll be thinking to yourself as an organization, why is this going wrong? Because we're now dipping down and I can't actually see what's going on. Oh, maybe it's the manager's fault, the CRO, as it were, or the head of sales in the international in my area. And the answer is no, it's not that. But we won't, maybe some companies won't see it for many, many quarters. There's a really large company that I sort of know quite well, and they got rid of their entire enablement team. I think they had about 20 to 30, one of the big ones. And now they're rehiring their enablement team. But it took them about a year of going through that, not having the fitness coach in soccer analogy with sales, to realize actually we need to have people together. And the best way, if anyone's listening and they're thinking, I'm going to get rid of enablement, or I'm not going to create enablement because of the recession, just don't do it, is my thing. Don't make that decision. Hire enablement or keep enablement, depending on your scenario, because you need your 90% sellers to be 100%. You need your 100% to be 110%. In fact, if you've got a problem in sales and you think enablement can fix it and you truly believe it, don't hire that extra salesperson, hire an enablement person, because you'll get the most out of your current crop, your current talent that way. And if you mathematically or you quantify it in this regard, that's an easy way to justify enablement. So, for example, it would take about 1.5% uplift of international sales revenue in my size of organization to warrant most of my team financially. Imagine if you get it to 5%, imagine you get it to 10%, which is 5 to 10% is where a lot of enablers try and target their sweet spot. My head of internationals just put me right next to the fireplace by saying my team's responsible for 20% uplift, you know, which is quite it's a bit of pressure for me. But that's how companies need to think about enablement. That's how 2023 needs to look at enablement. This is the year we double down. We need our fitness coaches more than we ever done because of market forces and the economy. And we need to make our salespeople better and smarter and leaner and faster and quicker in every possible way.
One of the things that you mentioned was you said it took almost a year for one organization or many quarters to be able to pick up whether the lack of enablement was negatively affecting revenue, which leads me to my question is, how can enablement teams, especially in this year, justify the cost of their spend, right? So you said you've got this 20% uplift benchmark for you internally, which is, you know, a really high bar, but what about slightly more immature enablement teams or mid-market companies where they might have two or three enablement professionals?
And yeah, I mean, the average is really in the UK is probably somewhere, it's probably about two. You know, a lot of people are individual contributors in their orgs, and there's nothing wrong with that. I was one of those 2 years ago. I was the only person international in at RingCentral for about a year and a half. And one of the things you need to look at, you need to try to quantify everything. So in many regards, you have your direct quantifiables, things that are easy to quantify, such as if you did some enablement with your partner community and it generated loads of leads, or you helped with an event, etc. These are really easy to quantify, or easier. You then have your sort of what I call your standard, quite hard to quantify, but possible. So stuff like when you do certain enablement programs, I use an example of one of those, which we've quantified a bit out at RingCentral. And then you have your really hard to quantify or harder to quantify. So things like happiness, it's a hard one to quantify, you know, because if your staff are happier, naturally most things say they're going to achieve more, but really hard to sort of really nail that down and how much enablement have contributed to that. So that's a harder one to do. The medium ones, which is where most of our projects and enablement lie, are things like sales velocity pieces, or being able to demo better, or qualification, or going from certain stages, or lead velocity, and all these fantastic topics. And so we had a piece where one of our biggest costs of a sale, and cost of the sale is a popular term in 2023, how much the cost of the sale, obviously we're going into recessions, cost of the sale becomes popular again. We had a bit where we were doing loads and loads of demos. So maybe we would have it, and that's natural. It's great. Customers want to see a demo. Forgot to invite someone. Can we do that demo again? Because we've we forgot to invite Bob or Sarah. Okay, we can do the demo again. We're a bit further on now, and I've seen this new feature you've got released. Let's do another demo. And you get to this sort of stage where potentially you might be doing one or two too many demos, where you could consolidate through a few tactics. Are you getting all the right people in the demo? Are you qualifying out properly enough so the demo is really as relevant as it could be? Those are the two sort of main ones, really, when it comes to that. So we did loads of work on qualifying out to make it that not only are we getting the list of what the customer needs, oh, I'd like to have this feature, this feature, this feature, but we're getting the standardized impacts of the business. What value would it add? What problems does it solve? These sort of standardized questions when we're qualifying in sales. We did a load of work on that. And what we saw is a significant dip in the amount of demos per sale, which is a really great thing to see in enablement, because one, you're helping the business, but two, the most important thing is it becomes then easier to quantify. You know, what goes into each demo? Well, you have to prep the environment. You might have to do a prep call before you actually go in front of the customer. You have to do the actual demo itself. We're now coming out of the remote only workforce way, and we're now going back. So maybe I have to drive there and do it live in a room, stuff like that. So the actual cost of per hour or per demo can be quite significant. There might be more than one person there. There usually always is. There's an AE at least, and the SE or your engineer or solution designer. These sort of things, then you can quantify it, and then that makes you build that value out. So I sort of answer your question from earlier. It makes it where you can start to quantify your projects. And that's my tip. Find something that you can not only have a quick win, because that's important to establish your internal brand as an individual contributor, but if you can find something you can get a quick win that's quantifiable, whether that's, doesn't have to be like, okay, I brought in 5 leads, those leads converted, it produced this pipeline. That's almost like they're the golden sort of apples. But if you can find something that you can do as a project where you can go, right, okay, the, you know, stage 4 to stage 5 or stage 5 to stage 6, or we closed X% more, and it's, you can see from this piece here that was directly linked to the training. If you can start to quantify that piece out, that's a massive, massive win for anyone in enablement.
One of the things I hear from a lot of different enablement people is almost not an internal fight or an internal argument, because we, like you say, the way that I've heard what you mentioned is we've got things that we own and you've got things that we influence. Right. So when it comes to the sales velocity equation, we might influence that outcome by doing a session on a specific topic. Like you say, qualification or demos or need, you know, how to, you know, get real pain or problem, whatever that is. Do you ever, certainly from your experience, do you ever find that you get sales leaders pushing back on the amount of influence after a program? For example, you're tasked with improving conversion rate from stage 2 to stage 3. You go, right, we did a demo workshop on that. It's improved by X%. Do you always get full credit for that swing? Is it a simple apples and apples comparison? We did this program, so we get the credit for this. Or do you still have leaders go, oh, well, it's not just enablement, we also did some stuff?
I don't think yes and no, again, kind of a bit of both. My sales leaders really sort of have a huge amount of trust now. So I almost have, I'm in the jealous sort of, or enviable part of my role where my sales leaders will say, okay, you've almost got full autonomy and we trust you to deliver. So I don't really get too much like this project, you can't really take credit for it. Sometimes some of my, you have the 3 key pillars in enablement, you have marketing, SOPs and sales. Sure, there are other pillars. In fact, there's multiple other pillars now we work with like the HR and talent team, you know, for onboarding, ramp up and experience and stuff like that. But they're the sort of 3 ones that if you don't have one, or you have a rocky relationship with one, then you can still be a good enabler and do well. If you don't have 2 of those 3, it's really hard. And if one of those 2 are sales, it's really, really probably impossible. So to answer your question for the sort of sometimes no, we need to be careful with what stuff we get credit for and what stuff, say, SOPs and marketing get credit for. But a lot of it is about, sometimes it's about empowering them and bringing them in, because deep down, the main people we need to keep happy are sales, really. They kind of know where the work's been done. So there's no point fooling them. They know if SOPs have done most of the heavy lifting, or marketing have done the heavy lifting, or if you've done the heavy lifting and been supported instead of actually facilitating fully. So I'm keen on always giving my marketing credit when they've supported me with a project. That's how I get them to support me fully and not like have enablement and marketing as silos, have them as one singular thing. Because I'm like, look, I can get you great attendance. I can get you salespeople using your collateral. I can help facilitate that. That in turn makes you more valuable and your team really look really good. So we can both truly win-win here. There's no us or them with it. There's no sort of one or the other gets credit. we can both, it's sort of a bit of get basic game theory. I can either get like 100 for the first project and marketing or SOPs get nearly zero, or I can get us where we both get 70-70. And nearly always, that's the strategy that will last you long term, because then you could, every project 70-70-70-70, rather than sort of, there's a famous saying, you can, shear a sheep 1,000 times, you can only eat it once. And a little bit like that with relationships are the same. If I steal too much credit for a project, it's probably not the long-term win for me. So that's where we try and position it. We try and have that kind of win-win, easier said than done type piece. But it is all about taking maybe the knee for some of it. So some projects I have where I'm like, right, I don't actually need the credit anymore too much. And this team are sort of struggling a bit. Maybe they've had a bit, they're going through some changes. And so I think they should get some credit. So I'll say, look, let's empower them. Let's get them to present on the training that they might usually just be a content producer. Let's empower them. And because we want them to be successful as well. So we do support marketing, SOPs, and all the people that support us.
Do you think that with all of those three pillars that you've just mentioned, that your objectives collectively have changed from last year to this year, and where the three of you should be aligning?
Because there's, for marketing, there's pressure on them more than ever because of pipeline, because people aren't as easy to sign up to things and aren't easy to sort of, they might try and push a project an entire year or 2 years, especially in stuff like SaaS, which is the generalized area that I'm in. Of course, there's pressure on them, and that will echo through into 2023. But again, it comes down to like, this is the year where we can achieve the most. Then it's not, if you see it as like, okay, we've got a higher hurdle, technically, like need more pressure on pipeline, potentially more muddier water. But if you jump over a higher hurdle, you feel a lot better than the lower hurdle. So it's kind of like, yes, the challenges are greater, but that's there. Then when you do win over those challenges, it's much more, rewarding, and it's great for you. You learn through adversity as well as a collective. So we try and kind of get in the boat together and both row. As a team,
you mentioned that you're in quite an enviable position with having that sort of autonomy. Obviously, I say obviously, I could be wrong, but it probably didn't start that way when you first joined Ring Central, right? You have to build that. So, I think you and I have had discussions previously, Ben, around some of the biggest issues that we see within enablement. Tuff, you've touched on already, is how we position it internally. How would you go about starting to build those relationships and starting to plan for showing that ROI as early as possible and position yourself as a trusted advisor to the sales leadership or the three pillars, whichever?
I think it's showing your value, which is a generic term. So let me break it down to actually something that context. When I joined my business, I still have the same leader as the person I targeted to get. Like, if I won that person over, I'm sure he won't mind me saying his name's Steve. He's the head of international now. At the time, he was head of UK sales, which was the office I was brought in to sort of support to begin with. So like, how do I convince this person that I can add value to their organization? Because they're already humming at a really great growth rate. Everything looks to be pretty good order. I do have sympathy for people. If you have to do your building and you're in a completely remote situation, it's quite difficult, because sitting next to a salesperson in a blitz day, or even getting on the phone with them or supporting with coaching, and sometimes you can do it through tools like Gong and others, you can listen to that. But actually showing that grind, so saying, look, I've listened to 100 calls and here's what I've said. And salespeople are really hard. The most successful ones are really super hardworking. They work long hours. They really earn it. And they will spot if you've done that grind. So I've listened to all these calls. I've sat next to sales, trying to chisel away at that so you can get that credibility with your leader. And then suddenly you go from being someone on the outside to a bit more trusted, and you grow that step by step, Lego piece by Lego piece, until you become, hopefully, what enablement should become, the right hand of the sales leader, the strategic sort of sounding board, however you word it. That is where you really want to get to. But there's obviously lots of steps you know, you do. It's not like, right, I've delivered a great bit of content. Right, when's your main strategy meeting for when you're presenting to the C-level? Because I can help with that. You need to make sure you don't run before you can walk. But that's how I sort of did it. I found a stakeholder that it was immensely talented. I tried to sort of help with anything I could, and I chiseled away. And now he trusts me with nearly any project. hopefully I am a part of his sounding board committee, and that's really where we're at.
Yeah, I think I found it similar, or I found sales leaders to fall into one of two camps, probably similar to salespeople, where you go to them and say, how can I help you? And you've got a laundry list of everything, or they're the opposite way, right? And they go, oh, we're good, we're fine, don't worry about it. And again, I think the way that I tried to break it down was, firstly, understanding what's their exposure to enablement been up to this point, because some people have got there without any help from any enablement or training and stuff like that, so they don't understand the value in it from the start, right? So then you're almost educating them on who you are, what it is that you do, and how you can be helpful. And then you've got the other side where they don't want to deal with any of their own problems, right? And they just want to chuck it all over to enablement and be like, can you just fix this for me and I can do all the other things that I actually like? So I like, because like you say, it's all about that relationship, and you're never going to end up as a trusted advisor or a right hand to anyone without firstly building the trust, then showing your value, right? And then after that comes the autonomy and stuff like that, like you mentioned, Trent. I thought that was great.
Related to this, in terms of like building that trust, and you know, there are, you know, three different categories, let's say, of how good someone is at enablement. So someone who's potentially just started, and the first thing they look at is revamping a sales deck and creating some collateral and maybe the initial piece of an academy program. Then you level up, you've got academy onboarding, you start doing strategy. And then at the level that you're operating at is you're impacting multiple different regions, have large headcount that you have to cater for. I was curious about was, what are the key differentiators of teams this year? Like, so ones that are potentially not going to succeed versus the ones that are best in class and doing really well?
I think my favorite adage with any, because I'm not a natural salesperson. I'm someone who has been in it for most of my, since 17. But I'm basically an autistic chess player, so that's my. It's not. I don't pass well on sort of the psychometric test. It doesn't scream sales when I get the report. But so I'm not a natural salesperson, but I'm a very knowledgeable salesperson and former sort of like sales leader, and was pretty good at sales. And the only way I did that without the natural talent was to do that. It's a generic term, but it is so true, is the small things well. For example, do your notes and put them in the system really well. It means that your SE team, your post-sales team, your marketing team, every team benefits from that. You know, so if you understand that, it means that when you ask for help from one of those teams, firstly, you're going to be at the front of the queue nearly always, because you're the person who does the hard work and actually does the system and follows the rules properly. That's the biggest tip I can ever give a salesperson. If you're someone coming out and you're a graduate and you're like, am I going to be gifted enough to be a salesperson? The answer is there is no yes or no to the like nature nurture sort of debate. The yes is you can be really successful if you follow the step-by-step guidance you're given. Our theme at my company is winners one. So winners one collective type thing. And that's because some of our deals will have 30, 40, 50 people involved internally for some of the biggest deals. They only get there by following the process, by engaging well, by doing things in the CRM, by utilizing the LMS, by attending the enablements, by doing all those things really effectively.
One of the things you mentioned, did the old magician's trick where have a look at these or you don't want this, you know, you kind of like dragged me into the question, and I suppose your phraseology of it was why 2% might be enough to save your enablement team. And I wanted to find out what the rest of that sentence was, because it's probably going to be quite useful for most people this year.
Yeah, so I kind of alluded a little bit earlier to it, but not fully. When you think about your organization, just think about how much new business do you do? How much upsell do you do? What's your revenue in general? And what kind of areas does enablement legitimately influence? So we influence upsell, often we influence retention and renewal, and we definitely influence new business. Sure, there might be other revenue streams you don't influence, so you can take those out. And you think to yourself, like, how much of a difference do I have to make? For a lot of, I've done some external consultancy work, a lot of orgs, it's 1-2%, which is quite a small figure. It's not 10, it's not 20, like my next to the sun where I am. It is very much 1-2%. If you think about it, like some your organization, you might say, well, Ben, not sure about, I might need more than 2%. I think you're in a enviable place. Often that will be that you might be an individual contributor and you might work for one of these unicorn companies that maybe inverted commas only has a few million in revenue or maybe 10 million in revenue, depends wherever you're at. Your growth rate will be probably double or maybe even triple percentage points. So you're in a great point. That's a great thing. But what will happen, like any organization, is your growth rate will start to decline. So then there's a different percentage that you need to think about. So organizations that are well established, it's all about, you know, growth rate. Can you help with, you know, attainment percentages and stuff like that? They're really important. But if you're in that scenario where you are working for a unicorn, so a big company, a small company that's got big sort of valuation and is growing at 100%, 200%, sometimes you see like 2000% if they're really a startup, you're going to have a depreciation growth percentage. Just natural maths will tell you it has to come down, otherwise you're Tesla in a few years. So what happens there is you go, right, can I stop that gradient from falling as quickly as it might fall? If you can help keep that growth velocity and position it like that, that is where you can start to quantify the value of your team. So if you're in that scenario, first, you're in a very exciting scenario. But secondly, you are in the scenario which probably needs enablement the most, that really sort of massive growth phase. You almost have the two extremes and it bell curves in the sort of downwards. It goes in a U shape in the middle. You have your very well established companies that maybe got clunky and complacent. They definitely need enablement. And you have your hyper growth companies. They definitely need enablement. Everyone in the middle needs enablement, but they're the ones that actually probably need it the most out of everyone. And so if you always think about, we sell in ROIs. Our team, we have to be internal salespeople as enablement. We have to show our value. And there's different parts of ROI modeling. There's productivity gains. There's growth gains, there's total cost of ownership metrics that come in. So actually, you know, saving costs. An example, my project earlier, did it save costs? Yes, less demos per sale. But it also freed up time for growth and productivity using those hours and time and costs elsewhere. So you have to see it like the double edge of a value assessment if you're talking to clients externally. But internally, that's how you have to position your projects. Because if not, what's going to happen is you go, right, well, unfortunately, we don't need enablement because we've only got 2 million in revenue. We're growing fast, but unfortunately, I have to make cuts. If you're in that scenario and you're a leader of a business, you need to find more investment. If you start cutting that, you're gonna go quickly up and quickly back down because your growth phase will die out, and then suddenly you used to be a $2 million company and you're a no longer existing company.
It's really interesting that you mentioned that there's a pivotal moment when you're one of these hyper growth startups following the triple 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 double double like Salesforce or Zendesk did back in the day. At what point do you think you have to switch as enablement from the narrative, okay, we're going to keep this sustained growth all the way through, and reverse the metrics, as you said, when you have to start protecting the growth trend downwards? Is there a certain time when enablement team should start in board meetings or when they're collaborating with the sales leader, change their messaging to, hey, we're actually protecting you from tailing off your growth rather than we're going to keep sustaining?
Most orgs look at their sort of renewal base. And you need to get involved with enablement if it starts getting into a double figure. So if your renewal base is 10%, as soon as you get to say 10%, you need to be aware of it and you need to start positioning yourself in there, because that number only goes up in most organizations. If you've got any form of renewal model, which most companies out there that are selling something do, then you have to start thinking about that, because in a year's time, it's going to be 20%. In 3 years' time, it's going to be 35%, and et cetera. So that number can only go up. It can hit a ceiling at points. That ceiling's pretty high. We're talking, it's probably got an 8 or a 9 percentage-wise at the start of it. And that's really, so that's how I always look at it. If you're out there in enablement and you're really focused on new business, which is where a lot of businesses that hire enablement really want you to focus, we need more new business, we need higher velocity, we need all those things we talked about earlier. Look at how much percentage of your area that you support has that renewal model and how much. And as soon as it gets to anything like, even if it's a single figure percentage, but it's say 7%, you know it's going to be a double figure percentage probably by the end of the year. Just on natural growth metrics. So, and then it's going to, you know, R1, I've seen it grow from, say, a double figure percentage to sort of a really, you know, quite a sizable double figure percentage. And it will only grow, you know, every SaaS company follows the same piece. If successful, you know, it will go up and up and up because you have happy customers and they keep renewing and they don't churn, which is the dream.
I've got one final question for you, but before that, I think you've touched on a really good point with regards to like the churn and the renewal side, because I think that's where, again, lots of enabled people I talk to, it's all very focused on like new business and discovery calls and stuff like that. I'm lucky in my team, we go all the way, we span the entire revenue org, so we have post-sale as well. I think one of the areas that seems to take a lot longer to get any sort of enablement help or assistance or support is that sort of the churn metrics and stuff like that. So, and I think that's, again, where you can form that sort of trifecta between enablement, RevOps and marketing around what are our leading indicators, what's our lagging indicators. You know, if we've got clients that are, you know, that are always renewing, or clients that are adding more and more products and more features on, and, you know, uplifting the revenue all the time, what is it that makes them do that? It's something that Mark Rebell speaks about all the time, and I think that's what he built HubSpot on, was, you know, get them in and then look at the leading indicators and stuff like that. And that's something we started working on where I am, in terms of like, okay, why is this account our biggest account? Because previously we looked at it because of the revenue size, whereas what actually, all these accounts that come on and stay on, they do this. So how can we decipher what those things are and then train our CSMs, or we call them client partners, and to model that behavior to get them to these leading indicators as fast as possible. But again, as I speak to a lot of enablement people, probably similar to yourself, Ben, and as I say, it just seems to be like that post-sale element seems to get less love from it. Like all the enablement investment seems to go for new business people or content writers and stuff like that. So I thought that was really interesting you brought that up. And my final question, you can give us the answer and then elaborate on it, or you can just be very bullet pointish. Obviously you mentioned 2023 is the year of enablement, or certainly you and I will think it is. We're going to promote it like it is. But if you were to focus on three things, your three main focuses for us in enablement team, and you go, like, if I could only focus on these three things, these are my three priorities for enablement, what would they be for 2023?
We've got this. Okay, the first one would be, got to start prospecting properly. And actually, one of the things that I find fascinating is the ability to adapt. So I use an example. So I've been, if I take training and development, I've been doing it like 11 years now with enablement. And at the start of my training career, I was told, right, okay, we need to get away from the phone and we need to do these sort of amazing new things such as LinkedIn messaging and emailing and video outreach. These are all the fascinating topics. And I did a fascinating thing. I was holding a sales enablement sort of society meeting a few years ago. And I asked, like, how many people here have had a message in the last sort of few days or this week? I said this week, and everyone sort of, yeah, of course, I get like outreach from all these companies trying to sell to me. How many of you had an email? Quite a few put their hand up. I didn't ask the video question because that's still a bit niche in some areas. I then said, how many of you have been cold called in the last week? About 3 people out of 50 put their hand up, you know. So about 10 years ago, we were told, like, stop doing dialing, because I used to be a BDR leader not too long before then. You'd ring them up, they go, oh, not enough sales call, I'll see you later, go away, don't want to talk to you, hang up, I've been hanged up, I've been sworn out, I've been, you name it, I've had it done on a phone. And now, if I get wrong, now as now I'm a buyer or even a candidate, if it's that area of my world, if I get wrong, I'm like, oh, I'm getting a phone call now from, yeah, as long as I'm not on a robo dial list, if I get a phone call from someone who's LinkedIn, I've been looking at your profile, I'm like, oh, that's quite flattering actually now. they've cold called me, which is quite rare. So we need to generate more business. As SaaS companies, we were in the fortunate scenario during the pandemic, a lot of us, where pipeline was quite good, and also we were quite cash rich as companies. You know, we had this is the whole S&P I'm talking about in general. It was very, very attractive. Well, we've suffered. Lots of other companies have, you know, every company's out there suffered a piece of that. You know, because of inflation, because of the economy. So my piece is, we just need to get back a little bit of old school, which is a bit of a weird one to say. It's the most modern year. Every year is the most modern year, but we need to get back on the. I know you're probably going to, really, this guy's going to tell us to get on the phone in sales. Yeah, ask yourself the question, if you think this guy for real. Ask yourself the question: how many calls did I used to get 5 years ago, 10 years ago? How many calls do I get now? Yeah. And if the answer is more now, you're in the minority, I'm afraid, from all the studies that are out there, because it used to be 5, 10, 15 times as many in, say, 2010 than it is in 2020. So and we're now in 2023. So that trend hasn't really turned yet. And you want to be the sort of trendsetter. You know, you don't want to be the follower. You want to be the trendsetter, and that will be the trend. I use an analogy quickly. I know I'm on my first one. I'll get to my second one in a quick. My daughter's now at university, right? And I grew up in the 80s. And when I was in the 80s, one of the coolest brands was Fila, right? I went through Fila and Kappa and these brands. They were really cool brands. I still think they are pretty cool. But when my daughter was growing up, and when she was like 8 or 9, I go, oh my God, look, these are Fila and Kappa. These are like really cool. And she would roll her eyes and go, oh my God, these are not cool, I'm afraid to say. And then even then, to her early teens, she was like, oh, these are not, why do you keep saying these brands? Lessie, oh, this is cool. And then suddenly I see these shops, them come back a little bit more. And then suddenly I start seeing them in the sort of high-end shops, and I'm looking at the tags, and they're like, pretty expensive stuff now, you know, like feel a pair of shoes getting towards the three figure mark. And they're like, oh, and my daughter on her like 15th birthday said, I really, really want this pair of shoes, right? And we went into the shop and it was a feeler pair of shoes. And I couldn't believe it. Like, you know, 7 years ago, you were rolling your eyes at me, telling me how uncool I am. Telephone in sales is like that. Now that is the, you know, in 2 or 3 years, we'll be back to, there'll be more phone calls happening. This year, my tip is get on the phone. The second thing, and I'll make this one shorter, don't worry, the second thing for me is building a brand of enablement. So I'm talking purely about what to do in enablement in 2023. So what I mean by that is, brand has two factors. One, it's your traditional brand, you know, make yourself look good. less so that, more so brand within a networking standpoint. So I said this on stage at the summit we met at in London, but if I have a project that I am struggling with, let's use one that you've mentioned. So the sales velocity equation. Say I'm trying to get that properly implemented, and I have done an okay job, but I could have maybe done a better job if I had done this back a couple of years ago. If I said, right, I'm really struggling, my sales stakeholder who gives me full autonomy is not giving me autonomy on this. I need to get this project done. It's going to add huge value. I believe in it. It's a great project. It's been successful at this company, this company, this company. I've said all this and they still say no. So there's two things I can do in that scenario. One, I can give up, right? And say, okay, the computer says no, it's not going to happen. Or the second one is I can go, right, okay, Kunal, who's the person who spoke at the thing, I can say, do you mind coming to talk to my sales leader for 15 to 30 minutes about how successful you've rolled that project? And in most cases, because I've done this quite a bit recently, I won't charge a fee. I'm not going to be charging consultancy fee. I owe you one type thing, or pay it forward. I'm giving you that sort of piece, and I'm asking you to sort of help my project. That is massive. And the problem is most people see that as a sign of weakness. Most people will say, okay, you're bringing someone in. Surely you should know how to position your own project. Yes and no, because this person's delivered and done and executed. I haven't done the last few bits of that. So bringing someone in like that, and we do it all the time. If you get rung up by a hiring manager and they say, I've got an amazing head of sales enablement job, it's £40,000 a year, right? And he's 5 years experience at least in enablement. The first thing you're going to go is, whoa, we need to have a conversation. I don't think you've priced this properly or understood the role. Do you want me to talk to the hiring manager and actually explain what we do? And the job spec might be wrong. We do it every day. We give that, and we do it in sales. The customer says, I really like what you've said, but I'd like to talk to another one of your customers just before I buy it. So why aren't we doing that in enablement more? Why aren't we bringing in people more who have delivered on projects that maybe we're struggling with, or for pieces of advice? So that bit of brand / network is the final one. And the third one really is, we need to get, if you are fortunate enough to get in front of sales in terms of physically, you know, to sit next to them and get to know them and build that brand that way. That's my third one, is to sort of, it's going to be a harder year. Therefore, we're running uphill a bit. So we just need to puff and run as hard as we can. So it's going to be a harder work. But as I said earlier, just because it's harder work doesn't mean it's a more difficult year. It means it's going to be, once you get over it, it's going to be a more rewarding year. So they're the sort of three, really, from my perspective there.
Amazing insights, Ben. Thank you so much on leaving on that gem. Or those gems, rather. Well, Kieran, thank you for joining me, and Ben, really appreciate you having you on as a guest. And tune in next week for the next episode of Enablement Evolved. Goodbye, everyone.
Thanks, guys.